Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode in tribute to our friend Vito Mestrangelo, a D-Day survivor who passed away December 9th at the age of 98. His memorial service will take place December 27th in his native Visalia, California. Vito spent his final years honoring those he helped bury throughout Europe during World War II, so many who never got to experience life the way he did.
I heard you say that there are some things you still can't talk about, and I'm not trying to get you to. But of the things you are comfortable sharing, for those of us who weren't there on what's been called the longest day, on Omaha Beach, from mid-afternoon on, what was the most difficult thing that you dealt with, the most challenging situation you had to endure?
The sights. Some of the sights were terrible. The guy that shot, you know, it's terrible to see him. But there's situations that some of them had horrible deaths. Like I said, it's been over 70 years. It's still on my mind. Terrible situations I've seen. It bothers me to this day. Many nights. Well, last night I didn't fall asleep until midnight.
Because you're seeing images?
Oh yeah, all the time.
And this has been going on for 70 years?
Over 70 years. You never forget. You never forget. Especially, we lost 18 men on what they call a dry run a few weeks before in the English Channel. That was shut up for over 50 years.
This is Exercise Tiger you're talking about?
Right.
Yeah.
They were 758 were killed by German PT boats that night, and 18 of our men were gone.
And you were there?
Luck of the draw again. I'm 3rd platoon. We didn't go out that night, but the 4th went out that night.
Wow.
And they got shot up. Just the luck of the draw.
And a lot of people still have never heard about that, but what you're saying, even though that happened before this invasion, the government kept it quiet.
Oh, yeah, for
and,
years.
And no one heard about it for decades.
For decades, that's correct.
But it was a big tragedy because here are the Allies practicing an invasion. The Germans show up and pick off hundreds of Allied troops.
That's correct.
And that would have been you if your platoon had been called.
No. I knew some of those guys at the 4th platoon. Some of those guys, their wives were pregnant at the time. They would tell me. And those children never seen their dad.
And here you are 20 years old processing that.
Yeah.
And then you hit the beach at Normandy. And when you say things that you see over and over again, I don't want to make you share any details you're not comfortable with, but what you're talking about are the way some of these guys were killed, the conditions their bodies were in, and then I imagine just the magnitude of it, how many there were. Am I on the right track?
You're on the right track, right on. Yep.
Did you sleep that night?
No. You know, the night, that first night on the beach, they said, okay, there's a German trench over there. Jump in that trench. You stay there all night long. It was an L-shaped trench. The leg of that L-shape followed the beach, and I was on the turn of the L. During the night, we got strafed. People that were lying in the beach. The next morning, I reached around the corner. I says, hey, how are you doing? I didn't hear a whisper from him. And when the sun came up, he was gone. Just arm's length from me. There again, the luck of the draw.
So German planes had come over at night and just strafed the beach. Yeah. And you heard it and saw it, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
And you knew it was coming close to you.
You hunker down and sure.
But it wasn't until the morning that you realized how close.
Yeah, that's right. Within 3 feet from me.
Wow.
Yeah.
Welcome to the war, Vito.
Yep.
Holy smokes. And if that wasn't enough, tell us about what you had to do on June 7th.
June 7th. Well, we started a little temporary cemetery right on the beach. And here comes a big old general. He says, we're not going to have a mass grave here because he's seen the bulldozer. It was a lot of sagebrush. We had to have that cleared off.
Right.
We had the troops dig in. 6 feet down, was he digging mostly sand there. But those bodies were moved later on in a week, at the end of the week, moved up the temporary cemetery that everybody saw on Private Ryan up on the bluff.
Right. But for that day, you probably spent that whole day overseeing the burial of hundreds of Americans right on the beach.
Right on the beach, 458.
458 dead Americans. Were you just numb to it all? or did you feel the weight of that?
You have to. It'll drive you crazy. Drive you crazy. What for? What for? We would have wives come and visit the cemetery. They were in uniform. They'd cry out. They had a hard time to. Oh, my God. So much. That's why I was, like you said, you've heard it from someone else. They didn't talk about it. No, nobody talked about it.
What allowed you to start talking about it?
People wanted to know more information. You start opening up a little bit at a time. Mm-hmm. And that's where I'm at today. It's been over 70 years, and I have talked about it. People wanted to know. For instance, when I went back to one of the cemeteries, the guide there was a Belgian man. He was in the Belgian Air Force during the Second World War. He trained in Arizona, so he knew the English language quite well. He says, I want to show you something. We went to the office. He went into his private office for some paperwork or stuff. And there happened to be a book on that little table. And as I opened that book, I opened this page. There's a picture of me. This was a staged burial. Myself was in there, and another fellow named Kistner, another Herbert. Kistner was from California. The other guy was from Illinois. They snapped that picture. And as he came out of the office, he started crying. I says, what's wrong? He says, the only reason that picture's in that book, because all the moms and dads that would come over here, they wanted to know if they were buried in just mud or something like that, or dirt or something like that. Well, I want to let you know that they were buried at that time in mattress covers. They were tied. It was a symbol that we had to do. We didn't want to do what that general said. We don't want no mass graves here. Mm-hmm. They weren't. So rest your mind, folks. They weren't. They were well taken care of. I know this day they're packed in ice and brought back. It's a different story now. But that at that time, there was no refrigeration for us.
So the best that you could do is get them in a mattress cover and get them in the ground. Did that mean something to you to hear him say
yes,
that photo,
yes,
just that photo,
yes,
provided comfort for families?
Absolutely.
That probably changed your perspective on what you did or why you did it.
That's right. I know I'm proud of what I did in the war. I know I talk a lot about the war stuff. A lot of people couldn't take what, but somebody had to do it. Everybody didn't fight with a rifle. There was mailmen, and there was cooks, and there was truck drivers, and I had a carbine over my shoulder all the time, but I never fired it one time overseas.
But just my guess, and I've talked to guys who are in every combat situation you can imagine, I doubt very many of them would want to trade their spot with yours.
That's what I've heard from time and time again.
An unenviable job. I've got to ask you, you described June 7th, and temporarily burying 458 on the beach. At the time, you have no idea what June 6th is going to be,
that
we're going to be talking about it 70 years later.
Absolutely not.
But now with the benefit of history and knowing how pivotal that day was in the world, how should those 458 guys be remembered? What's the significance of their sacrifice?
Those people were the first ones to die in France. I still remember them and how they were taken care of. But I have really no solid way of describing my feelings, or do I want to?
And that was just the beginning for you. That's the day that gets the headlines.
And 80,000 later, the last guy that died. Yeah, my company of 125, total is about 80,000.
That's how many your company buried.
Yeah, and there was maybe 8 or 10 companies in Europe doing the same work.
Yeah, so take us through past that, because here you are in June at Normandy. I know 6 months later you're going to be the Battle of the Bulge. In between that, I'm sure there are some other situations that stand out.
Normandy wasn't the only cemetery that was built in France. The 4th Platoon started one at St. Mary Eglise near the docks of Cherbourg.
That's one of the big stops now for tourists to go back, and they see the pretend paratrooper hanging from the steeple, just as John Steele did on June 6th.
He's still there.
Yeah. And a lot of the airborne troops were killed around St. Mary's.
Oh, yeah, a lot of them. Yeah, they flooded the fields, the Germans did that night.
So what would you guys have to do to properly establish this cemetery?
You had to find out who the owner of the property was and negotiate the cost of the land and stuff before anything happened. There's about three cemeteries. that were temporary in France. Then we moved to Luxembourg. We started that cemetery in Luxembourg. Then we moved over to Henri Chapelle, one of the big ones in Belgium. And then Margraten in Holland. And there was about three temporary ones in Germany. And then after Germany gave up, those were moved either to Henri Chapelle or Margraten, Holland. And because I dealt in wood in civilian life too, me and my translator, we took over a portion of a German sawmill. We made temporary coffins because we didn't like to move them bare on trucks, so they were temporarily placed in coffins and moved over to Margraten or Henri Chapelle. So me and this other fellow, we were in that town for about a month. Everybody else moved on.
But for a month, you're making coffins.
Coffins, yeah.
A month. I just want people to hear that.
Yeah.
Making coffins for a month.
Yeah.
To take care of all the fallen soldiers who needed to be moved to a proper burial.
That's correct.
And you talk about Henri Chapelle, and you've got photos of that cemetery during the war and when you visited later.
That's where most of my Belgian friends are. And you can't believe how many of those graves are adopted by the Belgian people. And on very important days, they bring flowers.
Is that where most of the fallen from the Battle of the Bulge are buried? The guys who died in Bastogne, for instance?
Yes, right.
Uh-huh. And what were you doing during the Battle of the Bulge? Because we've heard about the combat, of course, but also the incredibly difficult weather conditions that people faced there. What was that like for you?
Okay, that started either on December 17th or 18th. I'm not correct. I don't know if I'm correct on that. We were at Henri Chapelle still, in burials there.
So when the Battle of the Bulge started, you were burying troops already?
Oh, yeah. A lot of the troops were moving way behind us. We were maybe on the front lines there.
You're really close to
the
fighting.
We were afraid that paratroopers were going to drop that night, but they didn't. We were unifying the American cemetery when we had a lull in burials. The captain says we better start unifying the German cemetery because we thought we were going to be invaded. So they put a tank on the crossroads for us, and that's all we had.
That's your only defense?
That's all, just a light tank. January 1st, 1945. The weather cleared. All you had to do, look up and see those planes coming, American planes coming. What a sight. That's when they were starting to push the Germans back. We even got straight for German planes in the cemetery.
You're burying the fallen.
Yeah.
And they're shooting at you.
Yeah. Besides that, we had to worry about the buzz bombs.
You had those in your area?
Oh, absolutely. One fellow within 100 yards from us.
Explain to folks who've never heard of a buzz bomb before. Explain how that worked.
It's a pilotless bomb that flies very low. Say if you have a few minutes so you can sleep during the night, and then you could start hearing pop, 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 and you listen. If that engine shut off, you dive for cover.
Wherever that engine stopped is where it would fall.
That's right. One came over during the day. It was lunchtime. They hollered chow. So it was about three of us or four of us walking down this little path. And they flew real low because the noise is way behind. All at once we seen this bomb coming. Oh, I'll tell you, one of our fellows fainted right there.
Mm.
Had to pick him up and he revived real fast. But just the thought of finally looking up and there it is.
Mm-hmm.
And it landed, like I said, about 100 yards from us. Good thing it didn't cut out 100 yards behind us and it landed on us.
You keep giving us examples of this, of how close you came.
Well, there's, you know, I think I've said too much.
No.
No?
Never. But I am curious about that, and we're not even to the end of the war yet. We're still, you know, 5 months away from VE Day here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hearing these different examples, knowing how painfully aware you are of the death that's happening, where you are, and on the other side of the globe with your brother passing away. Were there ever times when you'd have one of these close calls where you thought, boy, somebody must be looking out for me?
Absolutely. You know what came to mind?
Hmm.
I would say to myself, I'm too young to die. I just keep repeating, I'm too young to die. I haven't seen nothing yet. Those are the words that came to my mind all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm too young to die. And here I am at 92. I'm still here.
Yeah.
The last 9 years, I took care of my wife. She had Alzheimer's. She passed away November 22nd last year. I was put on this earth maybe for a reason. I don't know.
Well, just hearing you say that right now, and only you would know, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it just hits me. You never asked for the job you had in World War II.
Never, never.
Nobody would have wanted to have to deal with what you dealt with.
No.
But is there a chance that having to experience and deal with and process so much death better equipped you to serve the people that were alive? Because you mentioned taking care of your mother for the last couple decades of
her
life,
right,
and
right.
your late wife, Teresa.
Yeah.
Do you think that what you did there helped you appreciate or understand or learn to deal with living people better?
Absolutely, it did. Yeah. It did. You know, my mother, my dear wife, I loved both of them deeply. I took care of them as best as I could. And my caretaker, we've had her for years, too. And she was very gentle with my wife, too. One day at the hospital, 5 days before she passed, she jumped on the hospital bed, hugged her, sang her a Mexican song. And that touched me so deeply. Last time I talked to my wife was 3 days before she passed. And I was at the foot of the bed and says, do you know my name? And I repeated a couple of times, three times probably. And she was drowsy. She kind of raised up her head and said, yeah, you're Vito, just like that. And that's the last time I heard anything from her.
Somebody knew what you needed to hear in that moment.
Absolutely.
And now they are reunited above. We're remembering Vito Mastrangelo this weekend on Hometown Heroes, a D-Day survivor who made a lasting impression anywhere he shared his story and his perspective. And we're going to hear more of that perspective when this special tribute episode returns right after this.